One thing I love about marketing is that every business needs it. When you work in marketing or social media, you then get to decide what industry you want to focus on, which can evolve and change over time as you learn what you like. From real estate to sports to wellness, healthcare, and everything in between. But what if you did marketing and social media for your favorite musician? What if the artist you grew up idolizing would later become one of your clients? That's the case for today's guest, Cassie Petrie. Cassie co-founded Crowdsurf, which is a digital marketing company who serves stars from Steven Tyler to Britney Spears, and she co-founded it while she was still in college. Today, Crowdsurf boasts a 35-person team with four offices and a roster of accounts with a combined 800 million followers, according to Forbes. In this episode, Cassie shares how she went from a fan to now being able to say, I'm with the band. But first, today's episode is sponsored by Vinyl. Vinyl reimagines how you discover new music. It's a vinyl record membership club that syncs with your Spotify, so you can get curated records sent straight to your door every month. And I know you'll look forward to unboxing three new records to add to your collection. Because finally, music lovers like you and me can learn about and remember new artists in a meaningful way. So head to vinyl.org to update your music profile and set the vibe for your first box. That's Vinyl, VNYL.org. Welcome to Making the Brand, the podcast where marketing and pop culture collide. I'm your host, Brianne Fleming. I can't wait to chat about brands, boy bands, and everything in between. Because brands who have a pulse on pop culture can create adoring fans of their own. I am totally fangirling over today's podcast guest. I am talking with Cassie Petrie. She is truly living the dream. Cassie is a Forbes 30 Under 30 and Billboard 30 Under 30 recipient and a 15-year veteran of the music marketing industry. You may know some of her clients at Crowdsurf, which is a top celebrity social media marketing and artist management company. She's worked with the Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, Camila Cabello, Pink, Ed Sheeran, the list goes on and on. So Cassie, I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So let's get into it. Like I said, you are just living every fangirl's dream. But when I say you're living the dream, I know it wasn't just like a snap of your fingers. You've worked your way to get to where you are today. So from fan to marketer, you were a diehard Backstreet Boys fan, still are. First and foremost, so how did you go from a fan in the audience to a fan working for them behind the scenes? We all want to know.
Yeah, I mean, it was a process. You know, it didn't happen overnight. I think my interest in the music business came from being a fan of theirs, but I don't know if I ever really necessarily went into the music business with the goal of working with them specifically like that. You know, I mean, I'm sure I never would have been adverse to it, but they just made me fall in love with not just them, but the music industry as a whole. And I really enjoyed watching, even if it wasn't them, I really like watching other people experience concerts, but then just experiencing really cool, memorable moments in general. Like I remember I was in Hawaii a couple weeks ago and I was on this beach and it's in shallow water. There's always sea turtles swimming in there. And there's something special about even like watching a person, whether it's a child or an adult, like see a sea turtle in real life for the first time and realize like, oh my God, like it just swam right by my leg and wasn't even thinking it would be there. There's just something special about watching people experience things that they're going to remember forever. And I fell in love with that experience through them and, you know, built out a career and business around it. And for a while, I was actually scared of working with them directly. You know, for several years before I started working with them, I knew their team or knew different members of their team in different capacities. And I could have pitched myself way earlier, but I never did because I was scared of ruining my life. I was scared of knowing too much about this group that impacted my life so much. And I was like, do I want to see behind the curtain? Is that gonna be bad for me? I was really scared about that. But at one point, after a really amazing fan experience, I was like, okay, I tap out here. It doesn't get better. It's like on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? You're like, I know I'm not going to get a better like score than this. So I'm going to walk away from the fan experience and I'm ready to try the business one now. And that, you know, but it took a second to get to that moment. And fortunately for me, working with them did not impact my childhood memories of them. And if anything, I think it enhanced them. They are amazing to work with on the business side, but I also think they're really kind people. I think the people around them are really great. I think their families are really great. If anything, it's just made it stronger and better and made me be like, yeah, I made the right choice. That I made the right choice as that being my band when I was a kid. So it's fortunately turned out really, really well.
I can see that. I mean, you know, they say never meet your heroes, but yeah, Backstreet Boys, I mean, they are just as amazing as you would hope they would be. And you're not going to be disappointed if you meet them. But I understand that wanting to like protect that, you know, that special feeling and yeah, not wanting to taint that experience and your memories of them. But I'm so happy to hear that they've only made it better. And that just makes me love them even more too. So
yeah, they're wonderful. It couldn't have been a better experience. And I just admire them so much.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you hesitated to work with them. So who were your first clients in the beginning?
So I actually started in country music before my business partner, Jade, and I started CrowdSurf. We're working at a record label in Nashville. We're working at Warner Music in Nashville. I was working with country artists. She was working with some country, some comedy, and some Christian. And I will say, going into country music, I really didn't know anything about it, but I was able to relate to the feelings that the fans had about those artists and was able to be excited and motivated about what I was doing through that. So some of my first big projects I worked on at Warner were Blake Shelton. And this was before social media was great for him, because I don't think people realized how funny he was, and him like getting on YouTube and then Twitter. I think it was able to kind of, you know, lend itself to those platforms, like really helped showcase how funny he was. And I think we're kind of a platform to eventually, you know, get him on The Voice and where he is today from a public profile standpoint, but was working with him, Faith Hill, Big and Rich, and some other, you know, pretty heavy hitter country artist. And then we worked there for 3 years. And then when we started the company, some of our first, you know, we were in Nashville, so a lot of stuff was very country centric. We got some independent clients. A couple clients from Warner hired us directly because they wanted us to stay on their team. And that's always a good sign of doing a good job when you leave a company and the person still wants to work with you. That means like you left an impression on them and they, you know, they saw value in your service. So we're fortunate enough to kind of be in that situation. And then we also picked up Capital Nashville is like a bulk client, and they have, you know, amazing roster. We were working on Keith Urban, Lady A, Eric Church, wow, and a ton of really big heavy hitter country artists. And at that time we were helping them, convincing them why they should get on Twitter, helping reminding them about like, hey, let's post some MySpace bulletins. Hey, you know, can we post a contest on your MySpace page? Let's do, you know, different fun things to keep things updated. But we were helping like design their MySpace pages, making sure the player is updated, making sure the top 8 is correct and all that sort of stuff. But so we really started, you know, very heavily in country music, actually. And I always think that's, I'm kind of grateful for that path. I'm glad that I didn't go straight in for like the stuff that I personally love the most.
Yeah. So take us to day one. How did you break into this though? How did you convince that first client of yours to hire you? How did you show your credibility or what you were able to do? And did you have any doubts or reservations about that? About how am I going to do this?
So my first foray into social media was actually in high school, even pre-MySpace, I was helping some local bands with pure volume pages, which is kind of a nice throwback. But that was really important in like the Warped Tour era, and a lot of artists actually broke from that platform and used it to connect with their audience and market themselves. So I was helping some local bands kind of in that genre run their pure volume page. So I already sort of had a little bit of experience with that, and I was also helping local bands with things like their email list, marketing local shows, selling merchandise at shows. I basically used local bands, and I'm from Louisville, Kentucky, to get as much experience as I could in music. You know, it's not necessarily a music industry mecca, so to speak. Maybe more so now with Jack Harlow being the king of Louisville, but at the time, there, you know, I found what I could to get experience, and that led me to getting a job as a Warner Music College rep when I was a freshman in high college. And when I was a freshman in college, MySpace came out. And again, it always comes down to like local bands for me. I saw local artists using MySpace to market their shows. And I went to my boss and I was like, why don't like big artists use MySpace? Like, why is it just like the ones at my college? And she's like, I don't really know what that means, but pick somebody and run their page. So I was like, okay, I really like the Click Five. So I'm going to run their page so that I get to work with them and I'm going to know their audience because I am their audience. So I ran the Click Five's MySpace page in conjunction with some of the guys in the group. And it was pretty successful. They were often the number one band on like the MySpace had a chart. They were often number one on the charts. I remember sometimes they would beat out like Fall Out Boy, which was a really cool moment. They actually got put on MySpace, had like a MySpace Records Volume 1, Volume 2, and the Click Five actually were put on that record that was released in stores. So that was a pretty big moment too. So I just it's weird. At that time, I wasn't really scared because I was just like, I was so excited, and I, you know, obviously didn't want to fail. I didn't want to mess up. But the thing that's really cool about doing something using technology that nobody else is using yet is nobody knows if you're doing it wrong or not. You're kind of like inventing the way that it's used, and you're doing something that nobody else is doing. And it might work, it might not, but nobody can tell you're doing it wrong because nobody knows the right way to use it yet. So I think there's something that kind of gives you a little bit of grace in a situation like that, which I am grateful for.
Yeah, it's just a lot of experimentation. I mean,
Yeah.
that's still ongoing too with every other innovation, or Twitter launches Spaces, or they do this and they do that. There's
Yeah.
so many changes, and you could try it and just experiment and hope it goes well, but learn from it.
Yeah, totally. You have to try it out and give it a swing. And sometimes it's wildly successful and sometimes it's a waste of your time. But you, even if it's a waste of your time, you learn something in the process. So I don't ever mind it.
So, okay, I love that backstory. You mentioned you weren't scared then. Have you ever had any experiences as your clients have gotten bigger that you felt some imposter syndrome, or you felt a little starstruck, or like this was out of your depth a little bit? How have you approached those types of challenges?
You know, I don't know if imposter syndrome, I mean, I guess everyone feels it to a certain extent. You know, sometimes you're like, wow, I can't believe I'm sitting at this table or I'm on this call or somebody just asked me for feedback on a song from this artist. Like those moments, you know, can kind of be a little surreal. But I always remind myself that if I'm feeling, you know, what I guess we've dubbed as imposter syndrome, I'm feeling it because I care. And if somebody cares and it matters to them, like they deserve a shot to be there. Because that's the number one thing that I look for when I hire somebody. Do they care about this? And so if that's what I'm looking for in terms of the quality of who I want to hire and work with, like I should give myself the same grace in a moment that might make me a little nervous. I'm nervous because I care. And that's and that and caring is a good thing. Caring creates magical work. It creates good moments. It creates hard work ethic. Caring is really important. You don't want, you know, and you know, you don't want imposter syndrome to be something that's debilitating and keeps you from your dreams. But I think if we all learn to, you know, think really mechanically about like, why is it there? It's there. You're not going to have imposter syndrome if you're in a situation that you don't care about. So if you just reframe it to be like, oh, wow, this is really important to me, and that's a good thing, I think that can really help in a lot of those kind of situations.
Yeah, that's just so profound and such a great way to frame it. And it reminds me of something I like to think about with just marketing in general and the best types of marketers and the kind of talent to look for, to your point, looking for people that care. I always say that marketers have the biggest hearts because yes, we do care. And also we're the ones on the front lines seeing what your customers are saying, seeing what they're going through and really understanding that experience and wanting to do right by them. And sometimes that can get lost in translation, you know, with your business decisions and your sales and ROI, we get caught up in that. But marketers are usually the ones that will fight for what the fans or the people are saying and what they're wanting. So I absolutely love that line of thinking.
Totally.
So what advice would you give to someone, though, who thinks that their goals are out of reach, that thinks that that star that they're reaching for just is never going to happen for them, that has some big goals like you have had and you've made them happen? So what advice would you share for those types of people?
I think it's always important to kind of, I call it sort of like either step laddering or staircasing your goal. So there has to be moments in between that you celebrate, or else it can become pretty hopeless. Mm-hmm. If you're like, let's say my goal still is, and I haven't accomplished this goal yet, is like, I would love to be a music industry mogul and multifaceted the same way that like you see an Azoff, for example, like, you know, has management but also like is involved in ticketing and has other business ventures. Like, that's, you know, where I would like to, you know, see myself as I, you know, get older and get more experience. But if I tried to go straight from high school to Azoff, that's, for most people, that's going to be really overwhelming and I'm probably going to give up. And like, I kind of compare this a lot to social media too. Like, if you decide like, okay, I want to do better at social media, and you look up best practices are going to be overwhelming at first. So you have to figure out always with your goals, what are the steps in between the big goal and where you're at now. And you have to, like, you know, it's like, what is the saying? Like, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? You know, it's not just eating the elephant one bite at a time, but you have to figure out how, like, you're feeling good about each bite. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you're going to be like, oh, but I haven't eaten the whole elephant yet. And that can be really depressing. And not to say that I don't ever, you know, I have issues all the time about like, oh, I'm this age and I haven't done this yet and I'm not on track. I don't know if I'm ever going to reach those goals. So it's really figuring out how to kind of, you know, break it up and do some things in between. And I think if you do reach your goals, like, it's important to make new ones, or else you can also become demotivated as well. Because at first my only goal was like, I just want to work in the music business, like, because that seemed so impossible. And so once I was in it, I was like, oh, I can like pick a path, I can get more specific things now, like there's more opportunities now. But I was so scared in the beginning that I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know I would get beyond like any job. I really didn't care what it was. So yeah, I was able to formulate new ones. So I think it's a combination of both of those things.
Yeah. And I think that's just kind of distilling it down to it being about the journey, not the destination necessarily. Yeah. And
then, no, it's cliche, but it's true.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense that you can enjoy the journey and you can enjoy those stepping stones. And one day you might be in shock of what you've accomplished and where you end up. So I also have no doubt that you will accomplish those goals and that you are well on your way to getting there as well.
Well, thank you.
So I'd love to know a little bit more behind the scenes. Where do you get your creative inspiration from, and how hands-on is the process with the artists that you're working with, and, you know, how they are sharing their ideas, and what is that process like, just the creative brainstorming for these artists?
So it's changed a lot. When I started in social media, it was like begging for anything to get posted on anything. And now, and I think this is a really good thing, almost every artist is super involved in the day-to-day of their social media, because you kind of have to be at this point. And, you know, I'm not super involved on day-to-day on most artists anymore. I'm more involved. My day-to-day kind of looks at more like running our company as a whole. I have a few like sort of marquee artists that I will never not be able to be involved in. So I'm still, you know, kind of in the grind on the day-to-day on those. And then I am like the artist manager for several artists. So that, you know, that takes up a big chunk of my time as well. But I would say in terms of the creative process now, it's a lot of group text messages. I would say, you know, I think it's a combination of like, so you have to have day-to-day communication because there's little things popping up. So sometimes an artist will be like, I have this idea for a TikTok I want to make. I shot this. I'm going to drop you iCloud. Can you help me edit it? Or I have this idea for a show ad, Matt. Can you make it? Or I have this idea for merch. Can you make it? Or it can be vice versa. I'm struggling with ideas on what my website should look like. Can you pull me some links for inspiration? You know, it really, you know, it's kind of a push and pull in terms of collaboration with a lot of our clients on that front. And a lot of times we like to go on site or set up in-person meetings to brainstorm too, because that can, sometimes that just opens a different type of dialogue and creativity and problem solving that maybe you can't get on a conference call or on a text message chain. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very, very collaborative and busy and, you know, everyday communication at this point.
Yeah. Well, kudos to you for getting some of those ideas off the ground, because I think if I got a text from a Backstreet Boy or from Ed Sheeran, or I would just simply freeze and not know what to do. So that is, that's really great that you're on top of things and can manage the fangirling at this point.
Yes, for sure. It's weird. Sometimes the people I fangirl the most about are like not who you would expect. I think one of my hardest moments was Max Martin. And that was legend. Weird. Yeah, I mean, legend, but I've wanted to meet Max Martin my whole life. And it was kind of, this is also a very sad situation, but also just kind of crazy. The first time I met Max Martin was unfortunately at a funeral home with one of the girls from GRL that had passed. And it was, that whole situation was just really sad and really crazy. That moment was really surreal, actually, like one that had happened with this girl that we all knew and loved, and just, you know, and then it sort of combining with like all like my childhood idols were there. It was really weird. It was a really weird, sad experience for sure.
Weird type of setting. Yeah. I can't imagine.
Yeah. But, you know, so but anyway, I guess back, sorry, it went kind of dark there for a second, but you know, back to like, sometimes I don't, the person I freak out about is like not who you would think it would be, but like it's like Max Martin, or I remember one time somebody from Hanson was in our office building this, and we actually work with them now, but before we were working with them, they were recording in our office building that we were in Nashville across the hall, and I tried to talk to one of them and like my voice just completely gave out, and I'm just like, okay, bye, and like I went to my office because I'm just like, can't speak, I'm just gonna back off slowly and turn around and go into my office, because in those situations, my voice stops.
Yeah.
And you don't, and sometimes you don't realize it. And then you're like, process it like the second sentence and you're like, oh no, this is not going to be good. I got to get out of this conversation as fast as possible. Yeah.
It's funny how you just shut down. I mean, I had an experience like that where I was at, it was a concert after party in London, actually, for the Backstreet Boys. And I was back there and this other fan asked me to take a picture of her with Howie. And I suddenly like forgot how iPhones work. And I was like, I don't know how to do the flash. Where's the, but like, it was just, everything was out the window. So it's funny how that can happen. And also a little embarrassing, but I think we all do come down to earth eventually, but it can be a little bit jarring.
Yeah, for sure. And it comes on at situations where like, you think you have it under control and then you're like, oh no, I'm freaking out right now. I'm freaking out.
Yeah, it's going to take me a minute, right?
Yeah.
So I love that you mentioned that these artists are involved in their own social media and their own content. And you said that at this point, they have to be. I would love if you could elaborate on that and to the extent that their online presence is a part of their personal brand. So what may be unique about doing social media for individual musicians and how it affects their personal brand?
It's tough because like with a brand, you can sort of like have a team and there isn't a person attached to it. But when a person is attached to the social media, you can't like, there's some aspects of how a brand social media is run that you can take from that in terms of processes and some best practices and that sort of thing. But when it's a, there's some nuances to it being a person. One, because it's a reflection even if they're not doing music anymore, selling product and completely change what they're doing in their life, like this is still a reflection of them as a human. And you have to really sort of keep that in mind. And sometimes you have to prioritize that person feeling comfortable over it being the best way to use social media. And that can be really, you know, challenging sometimes. And I see a lot of fans online sort of dog the social media teams of artists sometimes because, you know, why did you post this way? Or why didn't you promote this more? Why didn't you do that? And I'm like, it isn't like a brand. Like you have to, there's a person involved and they have a say, and they ultimately at the end of the day get to make a choice about, you know, what their name says on the internet. And, yes. You know, and if that's not best practices, I'm not bent out of shape about that. That's okay. The most important thing is that they approve it and they feel like it's a, you know, that it's a representation of them and that their account is aligning with their long-term goals for themselves.
Yeah. That reminds me, I don't know. Do you watch Ted Lasso?
I do. I love Ted Lasso.
Have you seen the latest episode? This might be a spoiler, but when Keeley and her girlfriend, mm-hmm. that a statement that they wanted to put out about she had an explicit video that leaked, and her girlfriend wrote up this, you know, very corporate sounding statement and an apology. And Keeley was like, actually, I'm not sorry that it leaked. Like, this is who I am. I don't want to put this out there. So it kind of reminds me of what you're saying, that like maybe on paper from a corporate or from like a PR standpoint, this looks like the right approach to do an apology or to do something this way. But if it's not true to what that person wants, they of course have a say. You're managing a person, not necessarily a brand.
Yeah, I thought that was, I really thought that whole situation was really well done in the show. And I'm ultimately happy how they wrote it in the script, because I do think it's like, as much as I understand like the corporate statement and how it should be done, blah, 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 I do think Keeley's instincts were actually, even from like a technical business standpoint, were more accurate, because I agree with that situation. Like, this isn't her fault. She shouldn't be sorry. It's not like she went on her account and posted this video, and even if she did, that's her right as a human. And I like how that story was told in that episode. I thought it had a really important message.
Yeah, I can appreciate that too, how we're getting a little bit more forgiving too with the internet and just letting people be themselves and not being so quick to pounce on everyone for every decision they make. I could never be famous, because I can only imagine how it is to have the comment section where everyone has an opinion on what you should do and what the right thing is. So yeah. Very well written.
Yeah, for sure. I really liked it. And I had an interesting moment recently where I was watching the Met Gala and all the outfits, and I commented on, you know, I loved Lil Nas X. I loved the look. I thought it was iconic. Like, people are going to remember that forever.
Yes.
I'm going to see that costume in WeHo this year. Like, that is a very memorable look. And I appreciate people taking risks like that. You know, it reminds me of like, you know, Britney Spears and like the nude sparkly suit or the red jumpsuit. Like, I remember people kind of reacted the same way. Like, that's inappropriate. That's this, that's that. But I made a comment on Billboard's post about how I thought the outfit was iconic and it was great. And I've never been roasted harder in my life for like being supportive. They're just like, do you have kids? And I'm like, oh my God, these are all the same things that people said about Britney Spears VMAs. This is crazy. Yes. But it was just wild how angry people were for me liking somebody's outfit. It's I can't even imagine what it's like. I mean, he handles it so well. Like, he like feeds into it. He's like, you don't like this outfit? I'm going to post a selfie with every celebrity, you know, in this outfit, like on his Twitter feed. Like, he's like, he like brings it, but like, I really admire his strength to be able to handle that. Cause even just like saying something nice about him was, you know, I mean, I don't take it personally, cause I'm just kind of like, I know that this is iconic and I know what this outfit will mean in like pop culture history.
Yeah.
But to see people so riled up about it was crazy. And I admire his strength to just like keep being iconic no matter what people say. It's really awesome.
Yes, he is definitely a trailblazer, I think, and someone that will always stay true to himself and just unapologetically do what he wants. It also reminds me of J-Lo and Shakira's Super Bowl performance, which I think is one of the best. And yet it was also met with kind of the same criticism. Like, do you have kids? They shouldn't have been doing this on TV or dancing that way or doing this thing. And it's like, you can't win no matter what it is. I mean, even Rihanna's performance was criticized, and it was safe and not.
It was very safe. Yeah. Like, it was like she was covered. It was safe.
Yeah. And yet people still, you know, criticize. You really can't win with this.
I'm like, that's your mind making this sexualized. That's on you.
Yeah.
The children watching this probably aren't making it sexualized the way you are.
Yeah. Yeah. And we grew up watching Britney in the cat suits and the sparkles and all that. And I think we turned out okay. So maybe it's not as bad. And kind of my parents' philosophy, they always said, if we told you you couldn't watch those things, you would have found a way to watch those things. And it was kind of like just a free for all.
Totally.
So I would love to know, I mean, you've mentioned that you've worked on MySpace and Pure Volume and the whole gamut, all the way now to TikTok. So I would love to know what trends you have seen on social media, specifically from then to now, some of those differences that you've seen over your career that spanned, you know, through the lifespan of social media.
So the thing that I think is really interesting is that a lot of these platforms go through similar experiences. So one thing that's happening, for example, right now is I remember when I worked at Warner in like 2005 or 2006, then YouTube was, you know, rising in popularity, and we were not allowed to use YouTube at that time because Warner was negotiating a deal with YouTube for royalties. And so you kind of hold back your content in those moments to like have more negotiation power. So it's interesting because a similar thing is happening right now on TikTok. Like Warner and TikTok are, you know, going through some type of negotiation. TikTok's not going to give them as much placement or support as they would normally get. They're probably not going to give as much like teasing music. You know, there's going to be a push and pull, but it's just interesting to me when I hear like younger people on the call be like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. And I'm like, I've seen this happen with every platform. This label's going to do this. Every major is going to have a negotiation period with every platform in terms of push and pull to come to like a royalties agreement. And then you see sort of the rise of platforms the same. And there's always like a big, you know, exponential growth moment. And that's when you gain the most followers. And then it's eventually going to tail off. It's the classic, like, you know, adoption bell curve, like early adopters going into main. Like, so when you kind of are getting, if you get on a social platform and early adopters and you're established during the big jump, like to the second, like 25 to 50%, that's when you're going to get like the most growth. And it's consistently the same on any new platform that rises to power. But that's why it's so important to be established on these platforms in the first 25% of adoption, because then you get the growth, then you really capitalize on that insane growth period. But it's the same process for every platform. I think we've sort of, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting now is, you know, MySpace died, it didn't stick around, but everything else is kind of, to a certain extent, sort of stuck around in a way. So, you know, the thing I'm trying to, you know, I guess develop my theories and philosophies on now is like how, you know, the process of how these platforms integrate new tools, like how YouTube adding, you know, shorts, how does that work? I almost kind of view those platforms sometimes as almost like an additional social network marketing, like launching. So I kind of view them the same way. It's like, okay, we want to use these tools, be early adopters to these tools, so when they hit their, if they ever hit a rise or gain speed, you're already established and you're going to get fed as people are signing up and looking for content. Because once you get to that final 25%, people's feeds are saturated. They follow more people than they can consume content. They're not looking for new people to follow, but in the beginning, they're looking for more stuff to put in their feed. So it's just a matter of, I'm always like looking at timing and like general population, but the problems we get in with like Instagram or Facebook and TikTok will be coming into it soon is there becomes a point when there's nobody left in the world to sign up for the platform. And so the only way you can really gain followers at that point is if you're gaining popularity in the real world in some other way. And then that just happens to flow over.
Yeah. I mean, that is a great compliment and segue to talking about the Backstreet Boys and their Black and Blue 100 Hour Around the World tour.
Yes.
I don't know if you were involved at that point, but for those listening who may not know, back in 2001, I want to say, the Backstreet Boys went around the world in 100 hours to promote their Black and Blue album because there was no social media. And they've always been a very high touch group, I would say. They love to be out there and to interact with fans and be seen, even now with social media. But I love that you bring that up, that those in-person fan experiences are still so important. And now that I think about this conversation and the direction of this interview, it's almost like that has been an afterthought. But that is one of the biggest pieces of it. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I remember I was probably, I definitely didn't work with them at the time. I was just a fan, but I remember like loving following the experience. I thought it was such a creative marketing campaign. But in general, I do think, and sometimes we do this at our company too, we try to figure out in-person moments, because in-person moments ultimately create digital moments. Like, it's, what do you want everybody to be thinking about on social media? Because like, think about like the Taylor Swift tour right now, Eras tour. It is, the most of the content we're seeing is not from Taylor posting it. It's other people posting it, but it's not created for digital, just people documenting it and sharing it digitally.
Yeah.
So it's just about creating moments that people want to share with other people. And social media is the way we share those moments with each other right now. But I actually predict that one of the next big trends in social media is going to be kind of a rise of, might be a new platform, but it could also be platforms that already exist, like Meetup or Eventbrite or that sort of thing. But I think apps that tell us fun things to do in real life are the next big winners right now. Like, I want the app that's like, what am I doing tonight app? I open it up and it shows everything around me that's going on and if my friends are going to it or not. That's the app that I want to see and let's know about. I want weird things to do in real life. Like, I love, I went on Meetup and I found a nunchucks class and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do a nunchucks class. Yeah. You know, I go on Airbnb and I find a guy in Hawaii who will take me snorkeling to the spot I want versus doing one of those all day boat tours. I can't do the all day boat tours. I get fried. I mean, I want to go swim. I want to go snorkel for 2 hours and be done. I don't want to like have to eat lunch and wake up at 7 a.m. I want to go at 10, be done at 12 and go to the spot I want to see. Perfect. And so I found like somebody on Airbnb Experience that can help me do that. I hired somebody from Airbnb Experience to help me do a surf lesson in a specific spot. But I like using digital right now to find fun things to do in real life. And I've also been creating fun things to do in real life. So my boyfriend, for his birthday, his request was he wanted to have a parrot lady at our house where people could like take pictures with the parrot on their shoulders. Wanted that. And he wanted a magician. So I made that happen. But people like had a really good time just because it was different.
Yeah.
So I think people just, I don't know. I think people want fun, unique experiences. And then a lot of times they're going to want to share those fun, unique experiences on the internet. So whatever app helps us have more fun, unique experiences, those are the ones that are going to win.
Yeah. I think that's a good prediction, especially after we've been holed up in our houses for, for 2 years.
Totally.
But to kind of echo your boyfriend and what he did for his birthday, for my 30th birthday, which was actually right before COVID, it was a 90s, I called it a 30 going on 13 party. So I had all my posters on the walls and cool things. But kind of the main attraction was that I had a yellow python. So we had a big Britney moment and people took pictures with that. So it's always That's a awesome. Hit having wild animals.
People know what people know what the python means.
Yes.
So yes.
Speaking of iconic, they definitely.
Yes.
So I would love to talk more about just some of the experiences you've had. I mean, you are so humble about all of this, but just some of the cool moments and highlights of your career, maybe, you know, a glimpse into a trip you went on or just a project that you never thought you would be a part of. Just what are some experiences as you look back on your career that you're like, wow, that is surreal, which you've also kind of touched on?
Yeah. Oh, I'm trying to decide which one to go with. Since we've been talking about social media, I'm going to go with my Tom MySpace experience.
Ooh, okay.
So when I was 19, I was working at Warner and I came to visit LA for the first time. It's actually, I think where it was the MySpace office is really close to where I live now. But I was like, I want to do business meetings in LA. So I had a MySpace rep that I worked with when I was at Warner. So I was like, hey, I'm in LA. I want to come to the office and meet you. And he was awesome. He gave me the tour of the building.
Tom gave you a tour?
No, not Tom. My rep.
Okay, gotcha.
But then at the end of the meeting, he's like, you want to meet Tom? And I was like, yeah, I want to meet Tom. So I go up to Tom's office and I get to meet Tom. He's really nice. He's like, why are you in town? And I'm like, oh, I'm going to go see the Click Five. A lot of things go back to the Click Five. He's like, I'm going to see the Click Five at the Roxy tonight. And he put them on the MySpace Records CD. So he was obviously familiar with them. And he's a fan. He's like, oh my God, I love them. Like, can I go? And I was like, yeah, of course, I'll get you tickets. So he gives me his business card. I still have it to this day. Me his business card. And I leave and I call Atlantic. They were signed Atlantic Records. And I was like, hey, I just met Tom from MySpace and he wants to come see the Click Five tonight. I know it's sold out, but can I get him on the guest list? And I was a college rep, so I was in like the Warner system. And they were like, we don't have space. We can't put him on. And I was like, okay, it's kind of important. Like, maybe like somebody from your staff can drop off and he can go instead, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we can't do it. We can't make it happen. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, I am not telling Tom from MySpace that he cannot go see the Click Five tonight. Yeah. Now, and just to be clear, like, I love the Click Five. I had seen them in concert like 60 times. I was obsessed with them. They actually opened for the Backstreet Boys on the Never Gone tour. Uh-huh. And so I got to see both of them multiple times. That was a really cool experience. But I'd seen them a lot and I really liked them. And it's still some of my favorite records to this day. And so I made the decision and I was devastated at the time. But I'm like, I'm going to go to the box office and I'm going to put my tickets under Tom's name so that Tom can go to the show, because I know that that is what is best for the Click Five. It is more important for Tom to see the Click Five than for me to see the Click Five again for like the dozen something time.
Yeah.
So I went to, and I was like bawling because I was like, oh my God, I came to LA for the show. I've always wanted to see them at the Roxy. Paul Stanley's coming. It's a whole thing, you know? So I'm like devastated, but I luckily found a scalper and I paid a fortune and I was able to go. I think that was like an important moment for me where I think I chose, and I think people in business, in the music business, have to do this at some point. If you kind of have the fangirl to music industry pipeline, at some point I think you have to make the decision to pick the business over the fandom. Or if you're truly a fan, you're in a situation like that, you're going to pick what's best for the success of your group versus like your personal experience. And luckily I got to have the personal experience. But I think that was like an important moment for me to show that I really was in this for like the business and helping artists on the business side of things. Yeah. But that was one of the like craziest. And then 20 million other things happened after that night. It was that was one of the most insane nights of my life and always will be. But it was very memorable. But I got to meet MySpace Tom that day and it was great.
He should have put you in his top 8 after that, after you made that sacrifice.
Well, I didn't tell him I did that. I was just like, I played it cool. I was like, I got you on the list. And then he asked me for a third ticket and I'm like, I can't do it. I was like, I'm tapped out. I'm sorry. It's really sold out. I can only get you 2.
You only knew.
But I saw him there. He came. Like, he didn't like, you know, ask for guest list and didn't use it. Like, he came to the show. I said hi to him. It was good. It was good.
Do we know where Tom is today?
Maybe. I follow him on Instagram and he hangs out in the best island locations. I see him in like Southeast Asia, Hawaii, staying at like amazing hotels and amazing beaches. It's pretty peaceful to follow, actually. I recommend it.
I love that for him. He definitely deserves that. What a pioneer.
Yes, truly. He was really nice. I mean, I was little. I guess he was probably pretty young too, but I was little at that time and he was really nice to me and like treated me like a, you know, business person. And I was appreciative of his respect towards me, even though I was very green and very young.
That's so great that he kind of pays it forward like that. I will have to follow him though.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So lastly, we just celebrated 30 years of the Backstreet Boys. And I think from your seat, just reflecting on 30 years is a really unique perspective. I would love to just hear your thoughts on their longevity, their impact on pop culture. I know it's probably hard to sum up all of that all of that love and such a great career. But yeah, in your own words, what did the Backstreet Boys mean to pop culture, and what will be their legacy?
So I think one of the things that the Backstreet Boys have done the best is just continuing to exist. That's actually the advice I give to a lot of developing artists now. Show up every day, be an artist on social media. And if you consistently show up and be an artist and are really passionate about that, it will eventually work out for you. And I think with them, I remember when I was younger, I remember I was watching the performance with Shania Twain and them singing it. And he was like, they're going to be gone in 2 years. And I was like, no, they're not. You know, I was probably 11. I was, you know, got really mad about it. I was like, no, they're not. They really haven't been. But I think they just consistently showed up, you know, and things haven't always been easy for them. Like it's really hard to go from being, you know, the biggest group or one of the biggest groups in the world, and then kind of have a record come out and not, you know, not do poor by any level of, you know, any standard at all. Like I think most artists would kill to have even the success of their worst record from a charting standpoint. But, you know, it's hard to like with, I think a lot of people would give up if they released Never Gone and it didn't sell the same way that Black and Blue or Millennium did, but they just continued to exist. They continued to be humble about it. They continued to just want to be a part of the music scene. And I think that with artists in general who have sort of a rise in fame, you know, kind of when they're younger, you're always going to have a lull, but then you're going to come back and become quote unquote legacy. And then you're going to be cooler and stronger than ever. And ticket sales will be the same, if not better, than they were in the height of your career. And I think they've kind of hit, you know, they sort of been around long enough where they kind of hit that point of like just being iconic. But the only way you become iconic versus washed up is if you continue to exist in a strong, powerful, you know, respectable way. You have to keep your integrity through it all from an artistic standpoint versus selling out to the cheap cash grab situations. And I think they've done a really good job of sustaining, and just it comes down to endurance. And it's cool to watch. I remember when I was younger, like boys made fun of the Backstreet Boys. And now like you'll see people after a football game, a video of them all singing I Want It That Way. And I just think, I was like, yeah, you used to make fun of them. You used to make fun of me for liking them.
Yes.
But it just shows that, I don't know, keeping doing it matters and consistency matters. And I think the fact that they're on tour right now, like that's crazy. That just showing up and keeping doing what you're doing is all that really matters at the end of the day, and withstanding and being able to withstand the low moments and finding the hope and motivation to keep going is everything.
Right. And they've done
longevity
as a group. You know, five people have decided that they're in this for the long haul through the ups and downs. So
yeah,
I'm sure they've leaned on each other through those lulls and those moments. And maybe one of them or two of them were, you know, feeling the effects of the lows a little more, and then the other ones kind of lifted them back up. I'm sure there's this dynamic of teamwork that's just helped them push forward. So I'm grateful for it. And here's to 30 more. Let's hope.
Yes. I always want to be able to go see a Backstreet Boys concert.
Always.
Yes.
Well, Cassie, this was so fun. Where can people follow you, and what artists should they be following? What's next? What should we know about before you go?
So on my social media, I don't post too much. I do DM and talk to people a lot that way. So on Instagram and LinkedIn, I'm at CassiePetrey, my name, Cassie Petrey. And in terms of artists to follow, I mean, I'm going to plug the people I work with, because why would I not? So I have three artists that I manage, and I think they all have amazing music and are either just released music or going to be releasing a lot of great music soon. But that'll be Lauren Gray, Leanna Firestone, and Katie Turner. Been working on music with them the past year, and they're in the process of releasing it all this year. And it's all really, really fun. Lauren Gray just released her full pop album, and I think it's really good. I think that it's going to sit there for pop heads to, you know, slowly find it and be like, oh, wow, I didn't expect this to be like a full listen, like bops, great record. So Anybody who likes and appreciates pop should go listen to her album, Guilty. It's awesome.
Will do. Well, Cassie, thank you. Like I said, this has been so fun. And thank you for sharing all the stories and all the insights and peeks behind the scenes. This has been a blast. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
If you're a fan of this podcast, be sure to subscribe, or better yet, leave a review. For marketing wisdom with a pop culture twist sent straight to your inbox, sign up for my newsletter at briannefleming.com/newsletter or find me on Twitter at Brianne2K. As always, thanks for listening.